Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. And we start today with the simmering debate over abortion, which is reverberating nationally and here in New England. Just this morning, Missouri Senate passed a bill to ban abortions after 8 weeks of pregnancy, without exceptions. The Missouri State House will now take up the measure. That move comes within a day of Alabama's governor signing into law what is widely considered the most restrictive abortion law in the U.S. Meanwhile, closer to home, Rhode Island's Senate Judiciary Committee rejected a bill yesterday that would have codified the right to an abortion in state law. Patrick Anderson, reporter for the Providence Journal, joins us now from the Rhode Island State House. Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So I have to ask you right out the gate, this bill passed the House. It didn't even get to a vote in the Senate. Were you surprised by that?
Well, we understood that this was the likely outcome in the week or so before the vote, but it's still shocking to ever see a bill voted down in committee. It's very rare to happen because the leadership in the state legislature has so much power, and they usually will just push a bill through if it makes it that far. So it was a very rare thing to see, and also a very intense series of events, even if we kind of expected it.
I think for some of us here in Massachusetts, there was initial surprise seeing this. But can you give us a sense? We tend to think of Rhode Island as pretty blue, but it's a little more complicated than that, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's similar to Massachusetts politically in a lot of ways, but the Democratic Party is a little more conservative or centrist. It's a little bit of a vestige of the old machine politics, and the leaders probably are a little bit further to the right in the Democratic Party here than in most other very blue states. And the fact that there really isn't a viable Republican Party actually makes that, I think, a little bit more the case, because there aren't the usual Republican-Democratic divides and polarization that sorts voters along these issues.
So with this bill specifically, I know critics, including the Providence Bishop Thomas Tobin, said that this goes way beyond Roe v. Wade. But the language of the actual bill spells out it only applied, quote, prior to fetal viability, that specifically prohibited partial birth abortions. Is it accurate to say that this would have been an expansion of abortion rights? And do you feel that there was an accurate understanding of what the bill would actually do for the people of Rhode Island?
According to the proponents of the bill and those who wrote it, absolutely not. It's not an expansion. Now, lawyers have been and can and will be debating that on both sides endlessly. The pro-life folks believe it is. The pro-choice folks believe it isn't. There are protections. You know, there's still the federal ban on partial birth abortion, which is still very much in effect. And some of the older laws that would be stricken if this passed have never been used. But really, the debate has focused on later term abortions. That's where the opponents of this bill have focused and have said that this would make those possible. And but the advocates of the bill say that's not the case, and that there's no danger of that at all.
Yeah. Speaking of those advocates, we spoke earlier with the bill's lead sponsor, State Senator Gail Golden, who was talking with us about the defeat. She said it was particularly hard to take because it fell on the same day that Alabama passed their most restrictive ban in the country. And so let's take a listen to what she said.
The Senate bill being voted down this week is deeply alarming. I feel the fear and the anger of women, not only in Rhode Island, but around the country. We are at this time in our nation where there is just a constant attack on women, and we're at a moment where we're fighting for who gets control.
So folks on that side obviously upset, but you also had a number of Catholic leaders, conservative officials who were celebrating the result. What are you hearing in terms of reaction on the ground?
Well, there, it, you know, it would break down as you'd, you'd expect. There, you know, wherever you, you come down on this, this issue, in the culture war, you're either excited or disappointed. I guess the only, the middle ground would maybe be some of the elected officials who, are going to are still having to deal with this. And, you know, even, even some of them that are pro-life personally realize that they are in a difficult spot and that this issue takes all the oxygen, out of the debate on anything else. And it's so politically charged, it create, could create a lot of, vulnerabilities in the upcoming election, not to mention things like passing a budget this year. But yeah, basically the reaction, you know, what from the church and from, pro-life folks was celebration, cheering, even to the point in some cases of gloating a little bit in the hallways after the vote, and just despondency and despair among the pro-life, pro-choice folks after the vote.
Speaking of the church, I know Rhode Island has a pretty significant Catholic population. According to the Public Religion Research Institute, it's the most Catholic state in the country. Past bills kind of like this one have struggled to even make it out of committee. This one did get passed in the House. Would you say it's fair to say that the religious influence is waning in Rhode Island at all?
It might be waning, but that doesn't mean it's gone. It's definitely, there is an influence. It's just about measuring it. If you saw this bill flying through, you could say maybe it has waned. There's also, an issue, this legislation, pending here, about the statute of limitations and priest that relates to priest sexual abuse cases that is, also, on the church's mind. And so far they've, been able to avoid, an extension of the statute of limitations, but that's also in the mix here. So far they've been able to hold out on these, two hot button issues, but who knows how long that will be.
Yeah. Obviously, this issue isn't going away anytime soon. It's expected to be a big part of the 2020 presidential race. What's next for pro-choice folks in Rhode Island? Are there other legislative options that they could potentially pursue?
Yeah, this isn't dead. The Democratic leadership is looking at compromise options. And the question is whether the pro-choice folks will accept them, whether they'll see that as watering down the bill. I mean, the most frequently mentioned compromise would be to further define the exception for the health of the mother of when you could have a later term abortion, and redefining the health exemption. So that has been talked about. It's unclear whether pro-choice advocates will go for that or decide that it's better to hold out and feel like they have the public opinion on their side. They have the political momentum on their side, and just keep trying until the pressure builds and this version goes through.
And I just should note, I mentioned the term partial birth abortion. I should have said a procedure known medically as intact dilation and extraction. That's Patrick Anderson, reporter for the Providence Journal. Patrick, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate the time.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Want to bring in another voice on this issue, and joining me now in the studio to talk about the implication of the challenges to abortion access across the country is WBUR's legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and also senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thanks for being here. Appreciate
it. Good to be here.
And before we go on, I just want to note right out the gate here that you worked on the 1980 case Moe v. Hanley, which established the right to legal abortion in Massachusetts based on the state's constitution.
Right.
So let's start with this news out of Rhode Island. Are you surprised to see a bill of this nature not even make it to a vote in the Senate?
Well, in one sense, yes, and in one sense, no. You need a better answer than that. But in one sense, the pro-choice people are trying to – these are ceremonies to some degree, because all the things that this bill tried to do by legislation – Roe v. Wade does by constitutional interpretation. In other words, it really wasn't necessary to do this, and presumably they did it in order to to make a point, which is to say something about the support for choice in Rhode Island. So in that sense, it's a failure that doesn't make sense because it's really not doing anything other than Roe v. Wade did. The post-viability abortions that are in the statute say are really track the language of Roe v. Wade for post-viability abortions. That there was a 5-4 vote out of the Senate after the, there was tweeting by members of the Catholic Church that shouldn't have surprised me, but it doesn't mean that the battle is over.
Yeah. I should note, I think that's what proponents were trying to do, was enshrine the protections under Roe v. Wade, and we'll get to whether there could be potential challenges to that, legally speaking. But let's look at this in a national context, because it's not just Rhode Island. We mentioned Alabama and Missouri. You also have Georgia, Mississippi, and Ohio who have passed laws effectively banning abortions as soon as the heartbeat of a fetus is detectable. That's around 6 weeks, which is around the same time that most women would realize they're pregnant.
Right.
So it's essentially banned. What do you make of the national push going on right now?
Well, it's a push that was emboldened by President Trump's two latest appointees to the Supreme Court, both Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh. In their previous writings, have made it clear where they stand on this issue. So this is a movement that is sort of betting on a 5-4 reversal of Roe v. Wade, assuming Justice Roberts will go along with that. And I think that that's actually a serious question mark. Most commentators believe that the Supreme Court won't take these statutes now, that Roberts would prefer things to continue as they have been, which is, sadly, regulating abortion out of existence, regulating even first trimester abortions out of existence, so that you don't have to take on Roe v. Wade head on in the way these laws do. So that would mean, what that would mean is that essentially the Supreme Court would decline to take these cases. It has no obligation to take them at all. The cases that are currently before the Supreme Court are the usual fare of increasing the regulation for abortion providers, where the focus is on regulating abortion providers and not abolishing the procedure. So they're all banking on a changed Supreme Court.
Yeah, they're coming right out and saying it. At a hearing last week, Alabama State House Rep. Terry Collins, who sponsored the Alabama bill, called her own bill unconstitutional. She said, "All our pro-life bills are unconstitutional right now. That's the goal." So clearly, as you're talking about, they're going for the wholesale overturn of Roe v. Wade.
Right.
Do you see the Supreme Court taking up a case that challenges, say, the Alabama law?
I don't see the Supreme Court taking it up now. I think that the Supreme Court has its plate full again on cases that are dealing with, admitting privileges for doctors who perform abortions when they never had to have admitting privileges at a hospital before. Down the line, who knows? This is a little bit in the weeds for your listeners, but last term and this term, just about a week ago, the Supreme Court overturned 40-year-old precedent, not with respect to abortion, to be sure, but it was up for 40-year-old precedent on other constitutional matters. Last year, they did the same thing. This year, the Breyer wrote a dissent to the decision in which he cited to the Casey decision. And Casey is a 1992 decision which reaffirmed the right to choose. So it was as if he was saying in his dissent, hey, are you going to do this to abortion next?
Yeah.
He was sort of flagging the issue. So the question is this. What's the desire of the court to overturn precedent, period? And these past two cases suggest that this isn't a problem for some members of the court. And then this particular precedent, which is precedent with respect to a very highly contested issue. And the third alternative is, or I'll just keep on the road of effectively making abortion rarer and rarer.
Yeah, I have to say you're underestimating Radio Boston and its listeners. We talked with your colleague Lawrence Lessig actually about that 1992 case earlier this week. I think that people are looking at the makeup of the court, and you have how would you break down where we know justices are going to rule? Is it basically 4-4 with Roberts as a potential swing vote?
4-4 with Roberts as a potential swing vote. Justice Kavanaugh has I don't even know how to say this, a more complicated approach. So he would want to look more at the facts, but the bottom, as opposed to a Justice Gorsuch, who seems more flat out ready to overturn this precedent. But Kavanaugh winds up on the wrong side of the issue in just about every case. So it's 4-4 with Roberts in between. From what we understand, Roberts' personal views are probably against the Roe v. Wade decision, but he is, as people describe him, an institutionalist. And an institutionalist has to care that the court is willy-nilly overturning precedent.
Yeah, but there was that opinion issued overturning a 40-year-old precedent.
Right.
And in the majority opinion, Justice Thomas said basically stare decisis, past decisions aren't the be-all, end-all, and we can overturn those when we feel it's appropriate.
It's actually even worse than that. There's a Federalist Society document that I found that says activist judges are not judges who overturn legislation or overturn former precedents. Activist judges are those who don't overturn precedents when they're clearly opposed to the Constitution. I wish I had known that when I was on the bench.
talk a little bit, if you can, about kind of the scope of what we're dealing with here. If the court were to take up a challenge of this nature, what kind of issues are we looking at in terms of how we define personhood and life in this country, and what kind of trickle-down effects?
Right now, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, and let's say you revert to the status quo before that decision. The status quo before that decision was abortion protection was a patchwork quilt across the country. There were states that had right to choose laws. New York was one. Massachusetts was sort of on the fence. And then states that barred abortion. So you'd return to that. In Massachusetts, we would be protected, in my view. And we'd be protected because of the 1980 decision that me and my husband, John Reinstein, did, which would situate the right to choose under the privacy provisions of the Massachusetts Constitution. So you would expect state Supreme Courts that have, you know, that are arguably more liberal to follow along with that. New York might be one. California would be one. Vermont. You'd almost track the same-sex marriage decisions in the state courts across the country. That would mean, again, as it had been before Roe v. Wade, abortion will be legal in certain parts of the country. Abortion would be illegal in other parts of the country. So it would be a patchwork quilt.
So here in Massachusetts, we know back in July, the state passed the Nasty Women Act, repealing a number of these kind of antiquated state laws that restricted abortion, contraception, adultery, among other things. I'm wondering, do you see anything that Massachusetts would need to do to shore up those protections? What would Massachusetts' situation be if Roe v. Wade was overturned?
Well, I don't. This is a strategic question, not a legal question. So, legally, it seems to me that Moe v. Hanley, this 1980 decision, establishes that the reasoning under the Massachusetts Constitution is even stronger. It says privacy. It says the right of a woman to make that decision fits under the privacy provisions of the Massachusetts Constitution. So I think things are protected. In order to make sure there's legislation that's currently pending, the Roe Act is currently pending that tries to undo the incursions on abortions even in a state in which they're legal, like forcing teens to get permission from their parents or a judge to access abortions. And then there is the ever controversial post-viability abortion. And in the Roe Act, it expands access after 24 weeks, that's after viability, in cases of fatal fetal anomalies. So I guess what I'm saying is the right would be protected pre-viability. The regulation under the Moe v. Hanley, the current restrictions would still be in place. This act is trying to eliminate even those restrictions. But let me just say one thing. The contested territory is certainly the post-viability abortions, and they are very few and far between. I had a case when I was a judge of an abortion with respect to a fetus that had no brain. And so people have to understand what post-viability abortions tend to look like.
Right. There's one other kind of tangent I want to ask you about, and that's IVF, how all this debate could basically translate to that. If you're arguing life begins at conception, it came up during the Alabama debate, and one of these state senators said, the egg in the lab doesn't apply. It's not in a woman. She's not pregnant. I'm wondering how you see that from a legal perspective.
Well, it seems to me it's a slippery slope, as we say, right? I mean, if the fertilized egg is determined to be a person, then it has implications for IVS. It has implications for certain kinds of contraception. If the Supreme Court ever went in that direction, it's literally the whole ball of wax of reproductive rights, which let me take a page from Justice Ginsburg's book. Justice Ginsburg actually believed that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided, not the outcome, but the rationale. And she said that abortion should have been seen as an issue of gender discrimination. It should be part of the package of rights that women need to have to determine whether to bear or beget children. And that it was not a privacy issue at all, but a discrimination issue. And if they had gone in that direction, it would have been a different situation.
All right. Obviously, we will keep following that story. I want to pivot for just a moment here while we have you. President Trump just spoke from the Rose Garden to launch his new immigration proposal. The White House is calling it, quote, a sweeping modernization of our dysfunctional legal immigration process. End quote. NPR's reporting, the focus of the plan is to encourage high-skill workers to come to the U.S. And discourage immigration based on family ties. Immigrants seeking to enter the U.S. would basically have to pass a civics test, and they'd get points based on their English proficiency, for example, or certain skills they're bringing to the table. Obviously, this administration has introduced immigration plans before that have been challenged legally. What do you make of what the president is rolling out today?
To the extent that he's changing the rules to get into the country, Congress is going to have to vote that. And that they haven't been so happy with bipartisan immigration reform. To the extent that he's narrowing asylum, he keeps on coming up head on with international treaties about asylum. In other words, we can't mess around with asylum when we are party to certain kinds of treaties. And I think the other thing I have to say is a personal matter. My relatives would have been kept out. My relatives came from, you know, shtetls in Poland and Hungary. They could barely speak English, and even their native tongue, they certainly couldn't read or write.
Yeah.
So it's.
Is there a case to be made, though, for we have to draw a line somewhere, encouraging people who are offering certain skills or whatever to come in? Isn't there?
They could.
A case to be made,
there's no question you can draw that line. That line, however, is a very different line than we have ever drawn, you know, at least to the turn of the century.
Right.
And I would venture to say that President Trump's relatives probably would have been barred like mine.
Well, that's Judge Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks as always for your time.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, how biology and engineering are coming together to solve our biggest problems. I'm Chris Siderick, and this is Radio Boston.